Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Greetings, listeners. Welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
It's the Feedback Show. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're here to discuss your comments from last month.
It was a month of science fiction-esque strange stories, and we started with Too Dark Clark, my nickname for A Walk in the Dark by Arthur C. Clarke. We spent some time on that episode worrying about technology eroding our ability to think. Professor Koschka writes, on the topic of technology, Socrates complained about written language, saying writing will produce forgetfulness in the minds of those who learn to use it because they will not practice their memory. Ironically, we know this because Plato wrote it down. Also, I remember people saying the exact same thing when GPS navigation became common in cars. So yeah, I think it's safe to say humans have always had concerns about over-reliance on new technologies.
Yep.
That's very comforting to know that about writing. It's kind of like when we covered the machine stops last year and learned about the threat of radio as it was perceived at the turn of the 20th century.
Right.
Why would anybody buy music when they can get it for free? What will become of the sheet music industry when people stop playing piano at home? So I guess things just change.
They do. It's a Ghost writes, oh, and one last thing. Chitinous is actually pronounced Frank Belknap Long. Just kidding. It's actually pronounced chitinous.
I didn't know that. I've always said it wrong.
I just think it's a regional dialect thing.
Well, I think there's a proper pronunciation for it. But chitinous does sound more like onomatopoetic. Like it sounds like what the thing sounds like in my head a little bit as a word. So I guess that's why I prefer that.
Yeah.
But now I know and I can't unknow the correct pronunciation. So
because chitinous sounds like some kind of flying paper object.
That's right.
I don't like that.
That's how I decipher words, is kind of thinking about what they suggest in my mind, and then that's what they mean. Michael Cunliffe writes, I can't believe that Arthur C. Clarke wrote the prequel novelization of Pitch Black. I remember that being a good movie, surprisingly. Like, I went to go see it thinking it was not going to be that good, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But I didn't see any of the sequels. Is that something I should look into, The Chronicles of Riddick?
No.
You saw them, right?
I have seen them, yeah. I mean, they're interesting. They're very different than what you would expect, but they're still kind of... Yeah. Moving on, Stacey Schumacher writes, this story made me think of the times I did bat surveys, often by myself at night. I would walk different routes with a device that recorded calls. The survey I did in populated areas generally felt like nice nighttime strolls, but one route was in this gnarly old cedar forest, completely isolated and alone. My rational brain knew that there was no one there, and I don't believe in cryptids, etc., and no wildlife would hurt me. But despite me saying this to myself over and over like a mantra, it was a terrifying route to walk alone with just a flashlight. If anything would have touched my shoulders, I'm convinced I would have jumped 100 feet in the air. Looking forward to the next time I do it, where a clicking sound may have a similar effect.
Well, I'm going to have to ask Stacy about those bat surveys. Do you just go around and ask them questions? Like, how do you know who they're going to vote for? Or
yeah, it's political.
Well, we have some bat-related scenes coming up in the tower this week, later on this week. So that was a good intro to that, Stacy. I was talking in this episode about how we... how having the name of something and then a number after it is a very science fiction kind of vocabulary thing to do.
Yeah.
The Lonely Sand Person writes, for what it's worth, planets with numbers after them is the standard way to refer to celestial bodies. Fargon 4 would be the fourth planet out from the star Fargon. Earth can also be referred to as Sol 3.
All right.
So yes. It turns out it's not a science fiction thing to do. It's just a science thing to do.
Sure. The one that I remember is, this is City Alpha 5.
That's the one I remember too.
Eric Speaker and Digressions writes, Chad saw Harrison Ford eating a salad? Well, this one time myself, I was delayed eating a salad because Tony Danza was standing in the way of the food while checking his phone. One of the great injustices in life.
Order faster, Tony Danza. Eric S. Vallone, M.D. writes, I believe that the most insightful statement regarding the cold indifference of outer space to humans who choose to travel through it was made by Rick Sanchez, who said, you young people think space is like Saturday Night Live. You see it every day, so you dream of being in it. But it dreams of removing all the air from your body and making you float around in it for eternity as a flash mummified corpse, which is also what space wants. So get back in the car. That is very funny, likely true based on experiences I've heard about friends of mine who went to go write for SNL, but I got to say, I'm not really into the pop culture content that comes up in Rick and Morty in some of the newer episodes.
Yeah.
They make a lot of references to like the Oscars and I don't know. I guess they're probably just branching out with new writers because it got renewed for 3,000 seasons, but yeah. It kind of, you know, that stuff's not going to seem as funny in a few years. So
yeah, I still like it though.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's still great.
It works for me.
I'm just, you know, saying that's a quibble I got.
Of course, of course. The Evil Cub writes, "The Cold Equations is a great story and a sci-fi classic, and I hate it. I hate it in the best way, but it's definitely in the category of art I experience once and never need to revisit."
Quite a few people, since that story kept coming up, even though we didn't cover it, a lot of folks were saying, you know, I'm glad you didn't cover it. Although we got this comment on a later episode, Kyle Griffiths wrote, "I have to stand up for The Cold Equations, even if it isn't appropriate for the show, which I can respect. It's a devastating read. I read it in the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, Volume 1, and this was the story that stayed with me and the only one that moved me beyond being entertaining." Mm. Yeah, I mean, it had an effect on me, too. I actually thought it might be kind of funny if we covered it, but used a new reader that people didn't know before who was just terrible. Because there's like a lot of really emotional monologues in there and stuff. Just get somebody who would just really mess it up. Or a child who would really have to struggle through it and not reference it. I don't know. That would have been a fun way to do it. But
Matt Shank writes, "So glad you guys are finally available on Spotify. I've moved over most of my podcast and music to there, but I've maintained a separate feed just for my favorite podcast. That would be you. Now I can finally finish consolidating."
Avalyn? Yeah, that's great.
Avalyn Starfall writes, "Arthur C. Clarke was part of the inspiration for the main character's name in one of the best horror games ever made, Dead Space. The main character is named Isaac Clarke, Isaac from Isaac Newton, and Clarke from Arthur C. Clarke."
That is a game I played, which is why I wanted to include that comment, because normally I haven't played these games, but I really enjoyed Dead Space. And I heard some rumors, I don't know if you know anything about it, that John Carpenter might be making a Dead Space movie or considering it.
I have heard that as well. I don't know if that's actually going to happen or not, but and that's a game I played, strangely, as well, and really enjoyed.
Isaac Newton, also the name of my great-grandfather.
Isaac Newton Pfeiffer.
Isaac Newton Pfeiffer. That is a true thing.
That is true. Dras Feratu says, "I've been listening to your shows for upwards of a decade. You finally got me to sign up for Patreon today. You sons of bitches."
Ah, we got you. Thank you so much for signing up, Dras Feratu. Really appreciate it. Paula Wyke writes, "I'm not a Clark fan, but I would love if you did the 9 billion names of God. It's sci-fi clunky, but oh, that ending." Paula, that is in our bullpen of stories to possibly cover in the future. I gotta say, I read it and didn't care for it all that much, which is why it keeps kind of getting bumped down the list.
Burn.
But maybe you need to read it and you tell me what you think.
All right.
It comes up over and over and over and over on lists of like the greatest sci-fi stories ever.
Maybe it's good to talk about things we don't necessarily like.
Maybe it is. Maybe it is.
And that gets us into Study 58, Alamaguza.
I feel like you just psychoanalyzed me or something. You know, maybe when some of these things come up, Chad, it's good to talk about them. On that Alamaguza episode, I talked about the comic superior officer in the story sort of reminding me of Ted Knight.
Matthew Alderman writes, "Ah, Ted Knight. My favorite line from his portrayal of Dippy Ted Baxter on Mary Tyler Moore Show was his comment, looking at the time zone clocks on the wall along the lines of, 'Do you realize there are people who are alive in Minneapolis who are already dead in Tokyo?'"
That's a great joke. Oh, he's the best. Richard Horseman writes, "Really didn't dig this story, but it did make me want to watch some old Sergeant Bilko episodes. So calling it a win."
Yeah, sure.
From a craft perspective, I did like that Russell frequently had dog-related stuff around when the off-og came up. The dog-related inventory items are listed right before the off-og. The cook exclaims, "Name of a dog," in French when he's being questioned about it. And of course, Peaslake is always lurking around at the beginning and during the inspection. The story was a long walk for a dumb joke for me, but I gotta respect the craft.
Yeah.
I thought it was our first extended dad joke on the show.
Right, yeah.
And it represented well. Illegal Structures writes, "If this story proves anything, it's that dad humor will survive into humanity's distant future." You were talking about on that episode about a photo of a woman at NASA early in the space program with a big stack of paper. You know how a computer was actually a person at the time?
Right, right. Steve writes, "I think the woman you're thinking of is Margaret Hamilton. The pile of paper she's standing next to is all the computer code she wrote for the Apollo program."
So amazing.
That's nuts.
Hester, I hardly knew her, writes, "Off dog." Off dog? Not much. What's off dog with you? We didn't make that joke on the episode, and it was just right out there. So thank you, Hester, for helping us amend that. Into our feedback show number 15, Riding Dracula, Kate Sherrod writes, man, some insightful mother folklores listen to this show. I always get new ideas about the stories from these shows in these comments sections. Been thinking about recruiting new listeners at this mature stage of the show. Well, thank you, Kate. It would probably be helpful if we developed a list of essential studies or some such. If there isn't one already out there, I'd be down to partner up with some students to develop one.
Mm.
So there's this new feature on Patreon they introduced called Collections. And we've been building those up, so it's a little different entry point to our classic shows. So we've done them by author. So if you just want to see the Lovecraft stories or the Arthur Mackens or the Ray Bradburys, and then we've also got some group by reader and some group by category, like vampire, werewolf. I think we can continue to build this out to find interesting entry points. So if people have additional suggestions, remember, there's a spreadsheet of all our stories and authors at either website under all episodes you can check out. And suggest some other collections we might put together.
Yeah.
That would be great.
The Evil Cub writes, I'm kind of saddened that Chris feels like he can't recommend the Dresden Files. Not because of how much he enjoyed them, but because of the supposed lack of literary qualities they possess. I firmly believe that the enjoyability of the read is a major factor in the quality of the book. Perhaps even the suitability of said book to be part of a class syllabus. Whoa. Mm-hmm.
In your defense, I will say you read... How many of those books?
Oh, God. I don't know. 9?
Yeah. So you weren't snobby about them because they weren't literary. I think that what you were saying is that that didn't sustain you going past like book 9.
Yeah.
You didn't want to keep reading them.
No. It's just they're kind of like, it feels like a nerd wrote them, which they did. And that nerdness is on its sleeve. And there's that quality to it where I would never recommend it to anybody that wasn't a super nerd. And it would be like a certain type of nerd. Like, I don't even know if I'd recommend them to you because I think aspects of it would bug you.
Well, I did. You did recommend it to me. I read one of them.
I wouldn't recommend it to you now.
Yeah, I did recommend it
to you then.
You like me more now or less? I don't understand what that means.
I just know you more, I think is what the answer is.
It did. Parts of it did bug me. I do remember that, yeah, because it was super pulpy. Although I just wanted to throw that in there because I think reading 9 books by an author is pretty darn good. There are not a lot of authors out there I've read that many books from. So.
Sure. Oh, yeah. They're super digestible. They're super, you know, every chapter ends with a little cliffhanger. So you're like, oh, got to read the next chapter. Got to read the
next.
And so in that respect, yeah, they're great. It's like popcorn, though. You eat it and then you're still hungry afterwards, you know, but you still eat a lot of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ryan Harrison writes, as you mentioned it here, I just want to say that I really loved your coverage of A Creeper in Darkness. I think those crazy bad stories were always some of my favorites from your earlier Lovecraft coverage and something that I was missing a bit. I think my favorite shows were stories that you guys actively hated. There you go. That's just what I was saying.
I think that would be a good collection for folks to help us out with because I don't necessarily remember what those were other than I know Lair of the White Worm is one we didn't like very much. But past that, if people have suggestions for a collection of so bad they were good episodes, that'd be great. David Parfit writes, fun story about watching Lake Mungo. My family was out of town for the evening, so I decided to watch it by myself. I sat on the floor so my dog could sleep on my lap. Right at the climax near the end, someone pointed a flashlight into a window from my driveway, a few feet from where I was sitting. I screamed. I quickly tried to get up, but found out that my legs were most definitely asleep. So I fell over, not once, like 3 or 4 times. There's still a flashlight shining in my window, so I was in full freakout mode. It took 2 or 3 minutes for my legs to start working again. Once they did, I went to the door to see what was going on. The interloper, now a safe distance away, just wanted to know if they could have a piece of furniture that I had put out for trash pickup. Thanks for the movie recommendation. That's awesome.
What was that person thinking?
They probably didn't know that Dave was sitting there, just had the flashlight out. I'm sure I've done the same thing.
I was picturing them shining it and looking in the house, but I don't know why they would do that. That doesn't make any sense.
I used to have this ridiculously bad car, this Geo Metro, that was so busted up. One of the headlights was askew really badly. It pointed like straight up into the air, and I could never get it to sit right. Even when I would adjust it, it would fall back into that position. So a lot of times I'd be driving down a residential street, and it was just beaming into people's windows on the second floor. A lot of people angrily looked out at me or thought they were, you know, getting checked out by a robber.
It's exciting. That gets us to study 59. Nobody bothers Gus.
It's not exciting.
It is.
That was the greatest blow off I've heard in a long time. Oh, that's very exciting. Your headlight story really excited me.
Matthew Alderman writes,
busted.
I think some of those are Bert and Guster's pseudonyms. Kudos. And
yes, you flew out with a list of pseudonyms from the author at the top. Is that where they came from?
Yes, they were. Yeah. That was for people that like Psych, which it was a show I enjoyed very much. But I sort of fell out with it, I think, on the fourth or fifth season. It just got to be too much for me. But those first couple seasons were hilarious.
Oh, it was a great show. You know, I think I might have actually watched all of it. But they have some movies, like continuation.
Oh, I didn't realize movies. That.
Yeah, yeah. I've been thinking about checking them out. It's a Ghost writes, I like how when achievement and being noticed didn't work for Gus, he drove his road car out to the country and found a simple house to fix up and garden to keep. That being said, he still longed to be noticed and to live with people. Cole Karen responds, it's a Candide ending. He must tend to his own garden.
Oh, yes.
That pleased me.
DR writes, there's a character called Glyph in the comic The Ballad of Halo Jones, who has a similar forgettable presence ability. In the comic, it's from changing their body and personality so many times that even they don't know who they are, and everyone forgets them, just like in this story. This made me think of Marvel's The Century, which is a character he popped up in the 90s, and they said he was actually around through the entire Marvel Universe timeline, but he was erased from everybody's memory. So they did flashbacks where, you know, he was in World War II and, you know, in the 60s and all that. But that was in the story. Some entity, I don't remember exactly why, but he got erased from it. In fact, I think there was a building in New York City that was blocked from people's vision that was like the Century Tower, and it had been there for decades, but nobody could see it because it was blocked from their memory so and their weird. Perception. So
wasn't he insane or something later on? Like he was like insane
side.
Superman kind of guy?
He was. He was definitely an insane. He had Superman-like powers. He was super strong, can fly, do all that stuff. But he also had this dark side called the Void, I think is what it was.
Yes,
and it would
get
out and just do terrible things. So he had problems. Matt Schenk wrote, I always find these kinds of stories fascinating. The question of what would you do if you could not fail is so interesting and revealing of human nature to me. I know you're both RPG nerds, but I wonder if either of you have ever played Vampire the Masquerade. That game puts you in a similar situation to Gus. You're given amazing powers and resources, but then cut off from the world at large. It's up to you to decide if you try to maintain your humanity, despite being largely removed from human society, or give into your monstrous nature. You can use your powers for some astounding feats of evil if you choose, but then you have to live with your choices, potentially forever.
Yeah, it's a great game.
A good point and a great game.
I've been thinking, I think I might actually start playing it again, actually. My D&D group might move over to Vampire the Masquerade.
Yeah.
But we played it when it came out in the 90s. I mean, crazy. Jeff C. Carter fights his way onto the show once again.
Oh, Jeff!
And he says something that was funny. Gus wouldn't need to become an astronaut or stow away on a spaceship. It sounds like he could create his own ship and explore outer space. He might not be able to lose there, but he could thrive in such a physically challenging environment as well as learn the society of that other alien race.
Mm.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
He came up with all these reasons why he wouldn't be able to do it, but if he's good at everything, couldn't he just invent the technology himself?
Yeah.
Matt Hirt writes, are you guys doing a show this week? Could have sworn I'd seen a notice, but just can't find it now. That was a good joke right away on this episode. Jeremy Empson also wrote, when you two couldn't figure out how many other stories were set in the Gussiverse, I thought, man, that forgetful field sure is strong. It's true. We couldn't sort it out.
Exanimus writes, is it about an author too awesome to be recognized so that they just go home and use their creativity to work on handicrafts? How do they remember he was out there to send them a notice about the highway? How?
Yeah, that is a good point. They sent a guy in his own whirligig to go out there and give him the notice, so they knew he was there.
Well, they knew somebody was there, but they didn't know him, so maybe that would be the excuse.
I guess his field doesn't extend that far. They just knew an address was there, yeah.
Yeah,
that's my guess. What it is. But I do like the idea that the whole story is a frustrated author going, I'm so wonderful, but nobody recognizes it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's the motivating factor in writing it.
I could say that. Shay Fargel writes, honestly, being effortlessly good at everything and being anonymous sounds pretty sweet to me. You get all the benefits of excelling at a given thing and you're not famous. That's a win-win to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Being famous, I imagine, would be kind of terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
I always think about when we were at Comic-Con working on The Chosen One and Danielle Fishel was with us.
Oh, yeah.
Promoting it. And when she came over to the booth, all of these guys turned their heads and looked at her, and it was really creepy.
Yeah.
It was like a mob of zombies suddenly descended and then you couldn't get around there and everybody was sort of grabbing and...
Yeah, that's weird because I knew her. I never watched that show, Boy Meets World, and we were right. friends for years. And I didn't, I was told she was famous. I didn't know she was famous. And right. then as I was friends with her for longer and longer, I got to see these weird things that happen when, you know, when somebody's famous and like yeah. people coming up to you and
you become public property to an extent
yeah.
and a non-person.
I remember talking to her about it and I said something and she goes, oh, I can't go to the mall. And I'm like, yeah. why not? And she goes, I'll get surrounded. It'll be a thing. And I'm like, oh God, yeah.
Because we're just a little too old for that show. But if
yeah.
had we been 5 years younger or whatever, yeah. might understand it a little more. So yeah, it was weird context to get because I didn't know Topanga was a,
nope.
was a big deal. But when I talk to somebody who's a little younger than me, they're like, oh yeah, you know.
Well, we have the same birthday. And we it was my 26th birthday party. And we had it together at the Dragonfly. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh,
that vaguely. Was the time that like Jake Yorton came up to me and goes, dude, you know Topanga? And I'm like, who's Topanga?
Right. It's really odd. It's just all a way for me to say, you know, I'm glad I wasn't more successful.
Yeah, that's
see,
me too.
I can manage to make it a positive.
Yep.
Extra credit number 15, Fire in the Sky and Why the Sci-Fi. Monster Talk writes, there's no better place to talk about the interplay of fact and fiction than in the world of UFOs. The first UFO stories were really promoted by Ray Palmer, who we all know from Amazing Stories, but who also created Fate and Flying Saucer magazines and paid Flying Saucer originator Kenneth Arnold to go investigate an early saucer story. Fact, fiction, folklore, and hoax all blend together until now it's almost impossible for any newcomer to the topic to figure out what the quote-unquote legitimate claims are and which are fantasy or literal fiction turned in on itself in an Ouroboros of narrative mixology. The question of whether any claimant is really believing or not, we've settled in on the idea of presumption of sincerity as the approach we take until we find evidence that something else is at play. I think that gives dignity to the experiencer and takes some of the steam out of the fool and the rubes kind of hoaxer.
At Monster Talk, they have their own podcast. They've been going for years.
It's yeah.
good stuff. Good skeptic stuff. Really neat. They talk about cool stuff. So yeah, I loved having their take on the UFO phenomena. Sam Saggins writes, I've been thinking about the discussion of 2001 that y'all have been having. I feel embarrassed at my need to come to the defense of a highly successful, iconic movie. But I do genuinely think that 2001 is meant to be a very specific experience that most people don't have access to. Especially in the late 60s, before the proliferation of home video, I would assume, maybe incorrectly, that Kubrick didn't intend for this film to be seen on a small screen at a reasonable volume. That may be a, well, duh, sort of statement, but it highlights how a movie theater experience is a fundamentally different experience from home viewing, and that my overall reaction and opinion to the film is so dependent on that. A couple of years ago, there was an IMAX re-release of the movie for its 50th anniversary. The only one I could catch was at a late-night screening that started around 10 p.m., I was the only person in the theater. I sat in the spot where the ridiculous IMAX screen just barely fit into my field of view, and the sound system, probably as a result of the theater being empty, was absolutely deafening beyond any movie theater experience I'd ever had before. The result was overwhelming as one would expect, but the scenes I found slow and boring before became engrossing as a result of the heightened sensory detail that became possible through its overwhelming presentation. In this setting, it may be the greatest movie I have ever seen, at least in the sense that no other movie has ever given me anything like that. At home, I'm like, oh dear Lord, why am I watching them meticulously eat their goofy astronaut food? Does a film's greatness include the criteria of being able to translate its experience consistently across viewing platforms? Ooh.
Such a great point.
Yep.
And so true. No, I do not think that a film's greatness should include that criteria. It definitely was intended to be seen
yeah.
in the theater.
Absolutely.
And that is a really hard thing to get over. I know when you make a film, like sound mixing, for example, you mix it in 5.1 surround and you have to do a stereo version of it for people because that's mostly how they're going to,
yeah.
you know, watch it. And that is it. You put so much work into doing it the right way that when you have to kind of print it down for stereo, it just makes you crazy that people mm-hmm. are going to watch it that way. Mm-hmm. And imagine if then they're going to watch your movie on their phone or something, you yep. know, when you spent so much time lighting little shadows in the background and. Yeah, it's actually a very good point, and I don't think it was intended to be watched lazily on the couch while half asleep at low volume, which is how I was watching 2001. So great, great point. Carter Stepper writes, I used to teach a sci-fi course to high schoolers during the summers, and one of the things we did was try to define it in such a way that Dune, Blade Runner, and The Expanse, among others, could all fit into it. It's possible that the moniker speculative fiction is a more precise one than science fiction, but if pressed to define it, I'd first center it on the question, what does it mean to be human? Mm. That is too broad, obviously, so I'll adjust it thus. Science fiction is a genre that explores the question of what it means to be human via possible futures and differences in science, technology, and human abilities. Not exactly quippy, but it's better than using the old adage for pornography, I know it when I see it. You know, I actually got a postcard from Andrew Lehman on this topic because he sends out postcards because that's just the kind of cool guy he is.
Yeah.
And on it, he wrote, one thought I had on the subject of what is sci-fi is that ultimately sci-fi is about human beings and space fantasy isn't. Star Trek is science fiction, but Star Wars isn't because there are no humans. And then the rest of his statement is obscured by the postmark. But I think he was making a joke about Star Wars having no humans in it. Speculative fiction might be better. That the definition that Carter suggests there is a pretty good one. But, you know, Jeremy Impson's comment that you've got here, I think, advances that thought a little more.
Jeremy Ibsen writes, genres are only useful as a suggestion for where to start browsing in the bookstore. I don't know where I first heard that, but I sincerely believe it is true. It can be fun to try and define things like science fiction, but if your conclusion is anything other than it depends, I encourage you to consider the question some more. In order to be useful as a signpost, genres have to be rather broad. The alternative is to be as specific as some music fans have become, oh man, resulting in micro-genre definitions that only describe one band, a period of time in one band's history, or a single album. I don't know what purpose that serves other than to be an updated way to say my favorite band is pretty obscure. You probably haven't heard of them.
Yeah, they're vampcore.
Oh, they're, God.
It's really tough. The stores make you do that, too. I know from selling music. We joke that my band is goth. We're really not by what most bands in that genre sound like.
No way.
But, man, I don't know what to do. I always just kind of put alternative. But then that throws you in with like REM and stuff, and we're definitely not that.
No.
We're just a noisy Halloween band, but there's no category for that. And it's really difficult, and it's true. It doesn't tell you much, but it does give you a place, I guess, to start browsing in the bookstore. So I do really like that definition. Yeah. Lots more interesting discussion on that topic on the comments section for that bonus episode. So I encourage people to check it out. We're going to do a similar grab bag of media this month for our extra credit episode, just talk about a few movies that we've been watching. So that'll be out next week if people enjoy that kind of thing. We're going to talk about The Fly, Jeff Goldblum Fly, and then you watched that movie Sator,
which
I was curious about. So we're going to talk about that stuff next week. But right now, let's get into study number 60, The Anything Box. Andy Watson writes, this one had me in tears. Great reading from Heather.
Great stuff.
Agreed.
Miss Charlotte Poe writes, this is the most wonderful story I have ever listened to. Never grow old. Keep imagining. I, too, wish I had an anything box. Ben A. writes, thanks for covering this beautiful tale. Weirdly enough, I call this an anti-Bradbury story. As much as he wanted to write about childhood innocence, most of his works were about how that innocence is lost. How refreshing it is to have a tale where innocence and a sense of the magical is not only kept for the child, but for the adult as well. It's also wonderful to read a magical realism tale that doesn't try to use that as a deeper lesson about life's capriciousness. See any episode of The Twilight Zone or recent series The Big Door Prize for a counterexample.
Yeah, the twist in the story is that it's not trying to make you feel bad.
Yeah.
You know? The little kid actually did something nice at the end of it.
Yeah.
And that was a surprise. When you see a kid in a story, you assume that they're going to use their mind to put you in the cornfield or something like that. It's just what we expect. Jim Cannon writes, the twist was that there was no twist. Just nice people looking out for one another with the occasional body slam for color. Hope you do more Henderson stories at some point. Professor Murder writes, as an educator, that's just a funny sentence right there. As an educator, this one gave me a great deal of intense feelings, compounded by the fact that I was on my way into work when I was listening. I work with students on the other end of their learning timeline, high school juniors and seniors in college-level courses. It can often feel like I am some final barrier meant to tamp down childhood enthusiasm and prepare them for the real world, waiting outside with hungry teeth. You hope they forgive you, and you find a way to do your job of peeling away the child and reveal the adult. You do what you can, and you try to live with it.
Whoa.
I mentioned it a little bit in that episode that as an educator, you know, you do have to sort of strip away some, you have to give some hard lessons to those students, and they might resent you for it, you know?
Yeah.
And definitely at the junior and senior level, you're prepping people to be adults. That sucks. You wish you could send them back in the other direction, but you can't.
Alan Ricks writes, aren't cell phones the anything boxes that we get lost in while staring at our own hands now? Wow.
Yeah. I guess they are to an extent. I definitely go to it when I'm bored sitting around in a line or something now, as I think most people do. But I do have a hard time sustaining interest in it. I wouldn't call it an anything box. It seems like the longer the internet is around, the more homogenized it gets.
Well, sure, but it's this thing that you keep in your hands, and when you're feeling bad or you need something, you need anything, you can go to your little anything box and watch a movie or read an article or read something that one of your friends wrote or look at pictures that you've taken of your life. Man, God. Yeah.
Have the president yell at you. Jenny Richardson writes, I forgot all about Anything Box the band. Living in Oblivion was the song played most at the club I haunted. And yeah, Living in Oblivion is a great song by them as well. Hopefully people went over to their Bandcamp page and picked some of their stuff up. Yeah. Zachary Nickel writes, I was listening to this while driving to a doctor's appointment. When it got to the last reading, I just started crying and I couldn't figure out why. The rest of the episode hadn't really hit me like that. In the brief time I've had to reflect on it, I think the innocent compassion of that moment really got to me. Mm. Also, Heather's delivery was top notch. So kudos to her and Zena for making a 40-year-old man weep in a parking lot.
Aww.
You know, if Dickens wrote a sci-fi novel, I guarantee the main character would be named Zachary Nickel. What a cool name.
It's a great name. Well, that's all we've got for this month. I want to thank all of you for contributing to this feedback, because without your feedback, we couldn't feed back.
It's a delicious feedback loop. Thank you all for being part of it and for supporting the show. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
The Feedback Show.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.